B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, December 6, 2018. Our dear tweeter, the self-described stable genius and tariff man, continues his destabilizing tweets. Markets around the world have declined sharply over the past week and again today. And all of this is compounded by the arrest of a Chinese tech company executive, a woman named Meng Wanzhou, who, it appears, was arrested in Vancouver last Saturday at approximately the time that Trump was sitting across the table in Buenos Aires from Chinese leader Xi Jinping. And we're told that John Bolton, who was also at the table, knew in advance about the impending arrest of the chief financial officer for the Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Bolton says he doesn't know if Trump knew. But this could turn into a major confrontation between the U.S. and China. Now, word is developing as this story grows some legs that the accusation is that this company, Huawei, has violated U.S. sanctions toward Iran. There are also reports that separate banking violations, international banking violations, may be at issue here. And Ms. Meng was arrested in Vancouver on Saturday. U.S. authorities are seeking her extradition, but have not explicitly said what the charges are. Today, Apple, Amazon, Facebook all declined by more than 2%. Yesterday, the markets were closed because of the national holiday declared in the mourning of George H.W. Bush. And around the world, markets were hit pretty hard in various parts of the world. In Asia, all markets ended the trading day down more than 1%. Tokyo, more than 2%. And investors shifted money into the safety of American government bonds. But this can lead to issues in the financial sector because of the lower yields from bonds. And we don't know so much about Meng Wanzhou. She is the daughter of the founder of this company, who was a leader in the Chinese military. The company was founded in the 1980s and is described as one of the largest telecom network manufacturers in the world. So the charges, we're told, come from the Eastern District of New York. And as I mentioned, John Bolton, the mustachioed, hard-line national security advisor to Trump, told NPR he was aware of the pending legal action. I knew in advance that is something we get from the Justice Department, although he added he didn't know if Trump also knew. Bolton declined to specify the allegations, but said Huawei is one company we've been concerned about regarding intellectual property theft and dealing with Iran. And Meng also serves on the board of Hong Kong-based Skycom Tech, which has business in Iran, according to information supplied by Reuters. Meanwhile, in the United Kingdom, Tuesday is decision day for the Brexit package, and it could lead to the decline or the downfall of the administration of Prime Minister Theresa May. Now, we're told that some of her advisors are finally starting to consider a plan B, because the vote that we reported to you yesterday, the contempt of Parliament declaration, well, that indicates that May probably doesn't have the votes to squeak past the House of Commons on Tuesday. And so conversations have taken place about what she might do, and several of her advisors have raised the prospect of another referendum, offering voters a choice between her deal and staying in the European Union. I know many people who are chomping at the bit for a retake of the Brexit vote. Now, those sympathetic to the idea believe she could win by guaranteeing an end to free movement And that, of course, is the borderless issue of no passports required to move from one country to the next. And it has myriad impacts, not only on movement of labor, but also movement of retirees, including many British citizens who enjoy lower retirement costs in other parts of Europe. Now, sources say that Theresa May has vociferously opposed the idea of another public vote. They said it's the only thing that causes her to lose her temper and raise her voice. The other option being discussed is softening the deal so she could win the backing of conservative Remainers and Labour members of Parliament in a second vote. So as you can see, it's very uncertain how this is going to play out. But it does seem pretty strongly indicated that Theresa May doesn't have the votes to clear Parliament with the Brexit package as it stands now. We will be watching. Expectations are described as low in Stockholm as the warring parties from Yemen will meet this week for another attempt to halt the catastrophic 3-year-old war. Now we're told that representatives of the Houthis arrived in Stockholm on Tuesday. The government delegation arrived on Wednesday. They say confidence-building measures before the talks included a prisoner swap and the evacuation of wounded rebels for medical treatment and the release of funds from abroad by the current nominal president of Yemen, Mansour Hadi, to pay state employees is also under discussion. So at least they're meeting. I don't have any positive sense that the conflict will end or that Saudi Arabia will stop bombing Yemen on a daily basis anytime soon. But I hope that we move toward that before millions of people die from starvation in Yemen. Back here in the States, the leak-proof Mueller investigation may be the source of this AP report. It says, spinning off from the special counsel's Russia probe, prosecutors are ramping up their investigation into foreign lobbying by two major Washington firms that did work for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. No sources are cited for this, but it could come from people like Tony Podesta and former Republican Congressman Vin Weber, whose respective firms, the Podesta Group and Mercury Public Affairs, are the target of further investigation. Now, I believe their roles are very important, but Bob Mueller, in the sentencing memo for Mike Flynn, passed on, as I said yesterday, what I think is the biggest issue, that Mike Flynn was lobbying for Turkey, earned $500,000, was scheming to kidnap Fethullah Gulen and return him to Turkey. And Mueller decided not to charge him for that, even for lying on the backdated forms that were submitted under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. So, in my view, Mike Flynn is just, you know, clearly guilty of violating the reporting requirements. And now they're going to investigate Podesta and Weber. This is a well-deserved investigation. We know that Manafort hired them through a murky European nonprofit, and they pretended that they were not paid lobbyists for Ukraine when their actions indicated that that was the case. So I support any kind of crackdown. But note that this has nothing to do with Russian meddling in the 2016 election. That was the mandate that Robert Mueller was given. And I'm about to play an excerpt for you of an interview that Rachel Maddow did last night with her favorite Russiagate promoter, Southern California Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, who is the inbound chair of the House Intelligence Committee when the Democrats take over in January. And he was asked to comment on the Mike Flynn sentencing memo and related issues. And I'd like you to listen carefully to his final comment in the interview with Rachel Maddow, where he talks about the connection between many of these people who appeared to be deeply corrupt and seeking to enrich themselves while they worked for Trump. And some of the enrichment involved prospective deals with Russians. Here is Congressman Adam Schiff.
And the final point I would make, Rachel, is there is a common denominator about a lot of these issues and a lot of these characters you're mentioning. As you played earlier, Maria Butina's conversation with Donald Trump in that interview was about sanctions. Mike Flynn was lying about his conversation with the Russian ambassador about sanctions. The meeting in Trump Tower between Kushner and Manafort and Don Jr., that they later denied happened and then admitted happened but said it was about adoptions, that was about sanctions. There's been allegations about Mike Flynn and a nuclear power deal that would involve removal of sanctions. Time and time again, there's a marriage of business interest, making money, and talk about sanctions. Eric Prince in the Seychelles meeting with a Russian banker. Jared Kushner meeting with a Russian banker. There are a lot of bankers. Alexander Torshin is part of that group, along with Maria Butina and Paul Erickson. A lot of players with a deep interest in doing away with Russian sanctions, including Donald Trump.
So I find this fascinating, because if you go back just 1 year and listen to Adam Schiff, it was all about Russia hacked the DNC. Russia gave that to WikiLeaks. Russia tilted the election in favor of Trump. Adam Schiff isn't talking about that. He's not hinting at any kind of collusion between Russian government officials and the Trump campaign to manipulate our election. He's talking about corruption, not about collusion. And this has been my central objection to the Russiagate narrative since it was spawned after Hillary Clinton's loss in November of 2016. I believe Trump is deeply corrupt with Russians. He has surrounded himself by cronies and flunkies who have corrupt intentions. Many of them appear to be working in concert, while others are kind of freelancing. And Jared Kushner was in with Mike Flynn on the nuclear power for Saudi Arabia, financed by Russian banks scam. But Jared Kushner also is out there for himself, using his position in the White House to try to refinance the Kushner family debt. They not only, you know, talk to Russia, they talk to banks in Qatar and in the other Emirates. And so I recognize that many people think I'm a little loony. They think I'm crazy because I don't accept this central notion of the Trump-Russia narrative. But look at how it has morphed. Adam Schiff, the Intelligence Committee chairman in January, isn't talking about meddling in the 2016 election. He's talking about the corrupt intentions of Trump's inner circle. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support this loony guy with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. I want to thank Joe Clarici. He is a staunch supporter. Carl Howard as well in Columbus, Ohio. Lyle Rubin. He was a guest on the show and decided to take out a subscription. And Anna Gordonier, a longtime staunch supporter of this podcast. Come on over to peterbcollins.com and join him. All you have to do is click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page. It's so easy. You set up a PayPal subscription. You don't like PayPal? We'll work with you. All you have to do is send your contribution to my P.O. Box, Box 15660, San Rafael, California, 94915. I will be happy to receive your support. Right now, there is a fresh Peter B. Collins interview that is available to you, whether you're a subscriber or not, at my friend's website, whowhatwhy.org. And in it, we talk about how Roger Ailes changed media in this country. He was the founder and chairman of Fox News, who resigned in disgrace in 2016 and died in 2017. And in a new documentary called Divide and Conquer, The Story of Roger Ailes, it debuts on just about every online platform except Netflix, and it will be in theaters starting Friday. And I spoke with producer-director Alexis Bloom. And in this excerpt, you hear her description of how Roger Ailes was a master of images and emotions that unified his target audience and divided them from the rest of us. And facts? Facts? Facts were secondary to the pictures and to the political load in the news programs offered on Fox. Here is Alexis Bloom.
The general takeaway point is that, you know, Roger was a master of kind of, in the film, this one woman calls him the Ernest Hemingway of campaign advisors. I don't think, you know, I think that's a bit of a stretch. But in, you know, in the same way that Ernest Hemingway has this kind of sparse, you know, clear style, so did Roger. He had this clear style that got straight to the point, and the point was normally kind of emotional one. You know, he knew that kind of it was easier to generate heat than it was to generate light.
Well, and facts were fungible to him. He used them when they supported his, predetermined, as you point out. He was interested in triggering emotion, and he was expert at using images that would produce the emotional response. The facts and the narrative came behind that.
Yeah. I mean, he never defined himself as a journalist. He actually had a pretty robust sort of, he looked down at his nose at journalists. He, you know, called them alcoholics and kind of was always joking about how if you want to get the biggest press conference, you've got to get the biggest bar going. You know, he was pretty much, you know, a showman. Alison Camerota says that in all her time at Fox, she remembers having a lot of arguments with Roger, but none of them were about journalism. You know, the facts were, I think, kind of incidental to the narrative for Roger. He knew a great story. He truly felt that he was sort of saving America, you know, in some profound way, that he was a patriot saving America. And I think a lot of sort of fact fudging was justified to that end.
I encourage you to listen to the full interview, runs about 20 minutes or so, available right now at whowhatwhy.org. A couple of alerts came out from Public Citizen today about the corrupt, conflicted people appointed by Trump. It seems to be almost a requirement that you be ethically compromised to serve in the Trump administration. And Exhibit A today is Andrew Smith, who is the incoming head of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection. He has conflicts with over 120 entities that are regulated by the FTC. And Public Citizen had to sue to get the FTC to release almost 500 pages of documents, many of them redacted. And Lisa Gilbert, VP of Legislative Affairs at Public Citizen, says, even in an administration full of unprecedented conflicts of interest, Mr. Smith's conflicts stand out from the pack. The Federal Trade Commission should be protecting consumers against predatory payday lenders and corporate bad actors rather than giving the corporate lawyer who has represented these companies a job. This is one more example of the fox guarding the hen house. And the attorney over at Public Citizen, Remington Gregg, says, I've written ethics agreements for White House officials. I've never seen a list of conflicts so vast across so many industries. And here's a list, just a partial one. Twitter, Verizon, Wells Fargo, Microsoft, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Expedia, Citigroup, LinkedIn, Uber, Gilead Sciences, Facebook. The list goes on and on. Andrew Smith is literally not able to do his job. He has ties to a vast universe of financial predators, likely to break the law, and he won't be able to enforce the law against them. We need someone who can. And a separate release from Public Citizen alerts us to the Senate confirmation of Kathleen Craninger to a 5-year term as the director of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Now, that was the agency that Elizabeth Warren set up under the Obama administration, and she should have been its first director. But Mick Mulvaney, who was deployed there to stop anything meaningful from happening, well, Craninger has been his assistant. And Lisa Gilbert, from Public Citizen, says 10 years ago, the economy collapsed after Wall Street glutted Americans with debt. Congress created the CFPB to make sure this never happens again. It's clear that Trump picked Craniger because she's committed to continuing Mulvaney's demolition of the agency. It's revealing that the only support for Craniger comes from the banking industry. Public Citizen applauds Senate Democrats for opposing this nomination. And Bart Naylor, who I've talked to many times, the financial expert over there at Public Citizen, watch your wallet, says Bart. Protect your purses, batten down your bank accounts. With the confirmation of Craniger, Trump and Senate Republicans are putting Americans at the mercy of predatory lenders and abusive financial firms. She has absolutely no training or experience relative to consumer protection. Worse, she has refused to denounce violations of human rights, showing a clear lack of interest in protecting the victims of abuse. Another rollback over at the Trump Interior Department. They are cutting by 500% the public land acreage that is protected for an endangered species called the greater sage grouse, a chicken-like bird that roams across nearly 11 million acres in 10 oil-rich western states. And why are they rolling back the protections for the grouse? Because they want to drill for oil. So it's nearly 11 million acres of habitat protected today, and they want to reduce that to under 2 million acres, and I'll bet they'll get away with it. Will they get away with the election rigging in the 9th Congressional District in North Carolina? Well, there is a fresh opening from the executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party, Dallas Woodhouse, who had been resisting the idea of calling a new election, said that if the State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement can tell them there was a substantial likelihood that the race could have been altered, then we would not oppose a new election. Now, this may be the only way forward. We've recounted for you the voter turnout operation with a lot of loose cash, a lot of people high on drugs, and they were illegally collecting mail-in ballots from voters. And it appears they decided which ones to turn in. This led to a 905-vote lead for the Republican in that congressional district, Mark Harris, over his opponent, Democrat Dan McCready. So we'll see. This could play out for another few weeks because the Elections Board is expected to hold a hearing on or before December 21st. And that panel, which is bipartisan, may order a new election if it finds that irregularities or improprieties occurred to such an extent that they taint the outcome. I've been reporting about how Michigan Republican lawmakers are brazenly rolling back the minimum wage that they increased for the benefit of voters in the midterm election, how Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, a lame duck, is signing bills to sharply limit the authorities of his Democratic successor, Tony Evers, and now in Pennsylvania, the hijinks of Republicans continue. They're using their cloud of legislative minorities and, in many cases, a Republican governor. And in this case, Republicans in Pennsylvania are trying to keep Lindsey Williams from taking a seat in the state Senate. She won the race after they challenged her residency, and a judge threw their challenge out. Williams went on to win the race, and now they are trying to declare her ineligible and decline to seat her. So a federal judge threw out that initial lawsuit, claiming that Williams didn't meet residency requirements. The judge was pretty stern, saying that the complainants had missed the deadline to challenge her eligibility. And he wrote that the question was an untimely and barely colorable claim. So the race was bizarre. According to this account at The Intercept, allegations surfaced that her opponent, Jeremy Schaffer, was behind a campaign. Behind campaign signs that looked like Williams' own, saying that she was a socialist. Apparently that's not true. So this, may be resolved in the courts, may be resolved in the legislature. But it shows that Republicans are determined to do everything they can to hobble Democrats who were legitimately elected to replace them. It's not just bad sportsmanship. It's really uncivil use of elective power. And that's the game they like to play. Advisors to Senator Elizabeth Warren are telling the New York Times that she blew it when she released the test results of her DNA in trying to counter Trump's bullying of her as Pocahontas, because she has claimed that based on her family history, there was some Native American blood in her body. And of course, the use of blood to define these heritage issues is controversial and offensive to many people. Advisors close to Warren say she's privately expressed concern that she may have damaged her relationship to Native American groups and her own standing with activists, particularly those who are racial minorities, and they're considering some kind of a public apology. And Warren herself was asked if she had regret. I put it out there. It's on the internet for anybody to see. People can make of it what they will. I'm going to continue fighting on the issues that brought me to Washington. And for some of us on the left, Warren's standing by the DNA test amounts to profoundly poor judgment. Some said she was too reactive to Trump's attacks, and others say the biggest risk in engaging a bully is that bullies don't usually stop, regardless of what the truth is. That's a quote from Charles Chamberlain of Democracy for America. And three people close to senior members of Warren's team said they were shocked and rattled by the senator's decision to take the DNA test, which they described as an unequivocal misstep that could have lasting consequences even on the 2020 race and who might or might not work on her campaign. Facebook is back in the hot seat with these emails that were released by the British Parliament. And what we are learning is that as Android phones rolled out, started to take a huge market share, and at a time when Facebook had gone public but was under pressure to produce revenues and to show that they could operate on mobile platforms. Well, one of the things in the internal discussions at Facebook were how to get access to call logs, the, you know, metadata of who you called and how long you talked, along with other information, like text messages. And they wanted to collect this without alerting the Android phone users and requiring them to give permission by opting in. And so there is this discussion between a Facebook executive. I didn't know he won the 13th season of Survivor, but his name is Yul Kwan. He describes himself as a privacy Sherpa in an article in Fusion that was published on the same day that an email showed that he was chatting with other Facebook staffers about how the company could vacuum up the call logs of its users without the Android operating system getting in the way by asking the user for specific permission. So this, combined with other revealed schemes where they're trying to position Facebook to generate profits based on the collection of user data. This shows that they were so aggressive and they were so interested in profit that privacy concerns were not just bulldozed, but workarounds were developed to try to essentially trick people into coughing up that valuable information. And finally today, after all the brouhaha over Amazon and the great jobs they're bringing to Long Island City and to Crystal City, Virginia, a big embarrassment at one of their distribution centers, a warehouse near Trenton, New Jersey, in Robbinsville. Yesterday, 24 employees were taken to the hospital after a robot that was gathering inventory and, you know, putting it in packages punctured a can of bear repellent. The can containing concentrated capsaicin compound in chili peppers was punctured by an automated machine after it fell off a shelf. And I don't know about you, but the packages have started to come for the holidays, and they do such a lousy job. They'll put your item into one box, and then they toss that box into a bigger box without any padding or wrapping or anything like that. And there is so much cardboard that is being wasted, and they pay to ship it to you. Is anybody listening over there? I'm glad you're listening. You're free to share this podcast far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.